Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Worksman's webinar on data protection and the implications of PAPIA on our day-to-day lives. We thought as a firm that it is vital that we start to unpack and in detail explore what the provisions of the legislation actually means from a legal interpretation perspective. We can't expect for our clients and the business community to work with and internalize the provisions of POPI without actually standing alongside them and walking with them through how the courts have interpreted the provisions of data privacy all over the world. So today we have with us a panel of four directors of Worksman's, and all four directors are actually focused in their respective practices on the implications of PAPIA in various industries and sectors. I think if we look on the next slide, I'd like to introduce all of the directors to you. I'm Amor Berger-Smit, and data privacy is what I do, together with competition law, and the two dovetails very nicely. If we consider big data and the implications from a big data perspective, on the competitive sphere and environment around us. We are joined by Jacques van Dijk. Jacques is in our employment law practice. He focuses on a daily basis in assisting our Worksman's clients on understanding not only the employment legislation, but more and more so focusing on what POPI and the implications of POPI actually how it impacts on the employment environment of our clients. We've got a cross-functional team and a virtual team within Worksman's, and we work seamlessly together. Jacques is one of the pillars of this virtual data protection team within the firm. Neil Kirby, the head of our healthcare and sciences practice group, has been focusing on data protection for a number of years, and we can all understand why it is so important that he focuses on this, because special personal information is a core focus area of the legislation. And therefore, it is important that Neil advises our clients on the unpacking and understanding of the data privacy legislation. And lastly, Tracy Lee Janssen van Rensburg, part of our banking and finance team. And again, if we cannot practice data privacy legislation, if we don't understand the impact of the legislation on our financial services sector and what the implications thereof are. So data privacy covers and impacts every single sector of our economy. And therefore, a cross-functional team of legal experts is important. We hope you'll enjoy this morning's session. We've picked four specific topics. And as you know, this webinar will be presented in two parts. Today, we will be introducing certain topics. And on the 8th of November, we will be drilling down into further specifics and linking it to why we deem it important to discuss these topics. So without further ado, one household rule. If you've got questions, please submit it through the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. What we will be doing is after each presentation, we will allow for questions on that specific topic. I need you to please make use of the Q&A function so that I am able to actually monitor while we've got the webinar ongoing what questions are being asked. And you can also upvote questions if that is your desire, if you believe a question is of particular importance based on a presentation. So with that having been said, we can commence with the seminar, and I think we've now got a sufficient group of people that have joined. So welcome, and then we can start with the first presentation. And today, that first presentation is focused on the thin line between love and hate that I thought was an appropriate topic for the discussion, consent and legitimate interest. Consent and legitimate interest, if we look at what it actually implies in terms of lawful processing, which is on the next slide, we know that there are six grounds for lawful processing. Consent being the first ground, and justification and legitimate interest the last justification. But to date, we know that we have heard a lot about consent. And again, if we look at lawful processing and the rights of data subjects, and we've got a nice table setting that out for you, we know one thing, that consent can be withdrawn at any moment. So irrespective of the fact that you might be relying on consent for a ground for lawful processing, once that consent is withdrawn, the processing must cease immediately. And that is so, so important for us to realize and know, because that justification for the lawful processing, once that disappears, the data, the asset you hold, that value will dissipate immediately if it's only consent that you are relying on as a ground for processing. You've got no ability, once a data subject objects and withdraws his consent, to you processing the personal information, to justify the basis and the reason why you're processing the personal information. And therefore, we deem it important to unpack and fully understand how to deal with something like consent and what it actually means, because it's also a dangerous ground and justification to rely on. And I'm saying dangerous because if we understand what the consequences of it, consent actually is, and what the requirements are if we consider consent, you will realize that it becomes a very complicated matter to unpack. And we will be using the Data Privacy Commissioner in Ireland's report on cookies to explain this to you further during the presentation. Now, the first thing for us to understand is, so the drafters of POPI, how did they understand it and how did they unpack it? And on the next slide, we actually do have the detail to a certain extent to give you an idea what the drafters of the legislation thought about in preparing the legislation. They recognized and realized one thing. Consent and giving consent for the processing of personal information is a unilateral act. And the mere fact that it's a unilateral act, and because it is a unilateral act by a data subject, giving the consent for the processing of his or her or its personal information, that consent must be able to be withdrawn without hindrance. It is important. Furthermore, if we consider consent, from the data privacy legislation drafters perspective, we know that they saw consent as something that must be expressly given, or it can be tacitly given, that indirectly given, and to have the consent in place. Importantly, is that the burden of proof for the responsible party, you that hold the personal information, that processes the personal information, it is your burden to prove that you indeed got the consent. And that consent must meet certain requirements to constitute valid consent. It must be voluntarily given. It must be expressly given or then indirectly given. But the data subject at the end of the day must be clear exactly for what he is giving his consent. So if we think about consent and we set that out in order to understand it more easily, and clearly, if we think about consent, it must be clear, it must match the expectation. What is this expectation? What did I tell the data subject? Why do I need the personal information and why do I need to process it? Does he actually understand the purpose? So it must be a clear purpose that matches with the expectation. And then, again, it must be available in writing or orally. We need to have a mechanism in terms of which that consent is given. And if we consider the consent given, we need to be able to compare it with the subsequent processing principles and actions that will be undertaken. So the purpose and to allow to determine the purpose becomes of crucial importance. We can learn from the GDPR. Why are we saying we can learn from the GDPR? Because the legislation clearly provides that we can take into consideration what happens internationally. So a definition in the GDPR is reflected on the next slide, which says to us, if we consider, if we can please move to the next slide, if we consider what consent actually means, it must be freely given. No one must be coerced to give this consent. It must be specific, informed, and unambiguous. So let's understand clearly what this consent actually means. And if we unpack it, and I said we will refer to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner's case study on cookies, we've got five specific issues that were highlighted by the Irish Data Protection Commissioner's detailed on the following slide. Now, what we do understand in terms of this. Number one, a data subject must be able to withdraw consent as easily as they have given it. Let's just understand that. If we also look at consent, you cannot bundle consent with other things to try and hide it for the data subject to actually not understand what he gave consent for. And then information on the ability and the mechanisms to withdraw the consent must be clear. A data subject must be able to identify the basis for withdrawing the consent easily and follow a due process. And the consent must link to the purpose. Now, what the Data Commissioner in Ireland did, they did a survey, a complete survey on cookie banners and how companies actually get consent for cookies. And they identified specific problems. And these problems actually appear worldwide. And it serves as a stunning example of the problems with consent and how data subjects actually do not understand what they are giving the consent for. For instance, if we look at cookie banners as such, in a lot of instances, they are pre-ticked boxes. So there are clear problems if we consider the cookie consent that companies try and obtain from data subjects. In a lot of instances, companies tend to favor and accept option in terms of giving the option to accept, but not giving the option to reject the cookies, the consent to that cookies, because that's what it's all about. Even where the Irish Commissioner, Data Protection Commissioner found, even where there's a provision has been made for an option to learn more about cookies, in many cases, it was so difficult to find that information to actually understand what it is. So the quick option was to nudge people, and that is the tendency that we see, people nudging, responsible parties nudging data subjects to just accept and consent to the use of their personal information. So what we understand from all of this, if we move to the next slide, is that data subjects have got the right to know. They've got the right to know exactly what the information will be used for. Therefore, if you're a responsible party and you process personal information, you need to meet the transparency requirements as set out in POPI. And that's how you need to think about consent. There are 8 conditions detailed in POPI, and you need to apply those conditions on your consent provision. So in conclusion, if we unpack consent for today, and the next session on the 8th of October, we'll move into legitimate interest. Data subject's consent must be specific, and it must be specific to the purpose for which you, a company, intend to process personal information. It links to further processing as well. You can further process personal information, but you need to understand how you do that lawfully. Consent must be freely given and unambiguous. It must be clear, a clear and affirmative action on the part of the data subject to actually consent, because at the end of the day, the burden of proof rests on the responsible party. So there's no thing such as obtaining consent by implication. Consent must be clear. That is an overview of the consent provisions, and I see we've got one question, and the question is from Mike Shirley that says, is verbally advised of withdrawn of consent legally binding? How would you document this? So if we consider verbal consent, there ought to be provision for verbal withdrawal. However, if we unpack the guidelines that the information regulator issued and the regulations, there are forms that the information regulator actually compiled and processes in terms of how consent ought to be withdrawn. So the reality in my mind is that companies ought to have a process and a documented process in place for the withdrawal of consent, because it impacts so significantly on the way we deal with personal information and how the rights you've got as a responsible party to actually process the personal information. I hope that answers the question. I note there are no other questions at this stage. Can we just ensure that that's the case? Because then we can move over to the next question. And you're welcome, Mike. This is indeed an interesting topic, and I think a confusing concept, because for too long, companies have been told to process and to lawfully process information on the basis of consent. And it is a dangerous justification to rely on. And you need to understand it carefully and also how you capture it within your data privacy policy and notices. We will now move over to the next presentation. And for this, Jock will discuss with us the employer's obligations under POPIA and while this should and ought to be implemented and understood. Thank you, Jock.
Thank you, Amol. Welcome all. I will be looking at the employer's obligations as far as processing personal information is concerned and doing so lawfully. As you can imagine, there's a vast flow of information between employer and employee from before the employment relationship begins and certainly during the employment relationships and thereafter. I want to today just identify that type of information, and I will touch on some of the legal principles that apply during that time. The one thing I also want to look at quite carefully is what information is provided to the employer at each milestone, so from pre-recruitment to dismissal and beyond, as well as, where applicable, which other legislation will apply to and come into play. So if we move on to the next slide, I've identified for the purposes of this presentation five main employment stages during which POPIA looms large, I think is a fair statement. There is a flow of personal information from the employee, in this case, the data subject, to the employer, the responsible party, and back, and then often to third parties as well. The first stage I call the pre-recruitment stage. At this stage, employers formulate a wish list for a potential new recruit. They have a vacancy and they consider what they need from an applicant, and they decide what sort of information they need in order to assess that person. They decide what information they will get during the recruitment phase. And at this stage, it's important that employers give thought to the restrictions placed on that processing of that personal information and often special personal information that will be gathered during that process. The second stage, as I see it, is what I call the actual recruitment stage. So this is when the information is received from the employee, gathered and interrogated by the employer and processed, for example, by forwarding to credit bureaus or to private investigators in some cases to check for criminal offences. The collection of this information often is linked to the inherent requirements of the position and often involves the collection of special personal information. The reason I refer to inherent requirements of the job is that's a notion that arises in the Labor Relations Act. And it is clear that in that case, an employer is entitled by law to obtain information relating to the inherent requirements of the job. So we have an interplay between POPIA at this point and the Labor Relations Act, for instance. So too, the collection of special personal information is provided for at this stage by the Employment Equity Act, which we all know provides for affirmative action policies and special measures to be taken for persons who are regarded as part of a previously disadvantaged group. So for instance, race, gender, and such information is collected at this stage lawfully under the Employment Equity Act. So again, we have an interplay between POPIA and the Employment Equity Act in regard to the processing of that information, the retention of that information, and often the passing on of that information. The third stage follows the appointment of the employee. And there we know, as employers and employees, there's a continuous flow of information between the parties. The employer collects information in order to prepare a letter of appointment or a contract of employment. We know from the principles governing lawful processing that this is permitted. We also know that often the employee's consent is sought, and I'm not going to repeat what Amor said, but those principles on consent and the withdrawal of consent apply equally. But bear in mind that an employer may process information if necessary to give effect to a contract of employment. Employee must know about that though, of course. So the employer will collect information to facilitate the employee joining the pension or provident fund. You can imagine this entails a lot of special personal information about dependents, addresses, ages, health conditions, and such. Also for medical aids, here again, prior medical conditions will be disclosed, falling squarely within the provisions of POPIA and requiring an employer to be extremely cautious. Sometimes employers require employees to undergo medical examinations. Again, here we have an interplay with the Employment Equity Act, which strictly regulates medical examinations, but permits it in certain circumstances, and that will be important for deciding whether the processing is lawful under POPIA. The fourth stage, as I see it, involves the termination of employment. You have information such as the final salary, the reason for the dismissal, minutes of disciplinary hearings, which can be very personal, for instance, relating to sexual harassment matters. That sort of information is gathered and processed by an employer and retained for a certain period of time by law. Both the Labor Relations Act requires it and POPIA requires it. The last stage in the employment life cycle, as I see it, is post-termination. Here the issue is, well, how long do you retain personal information gathered during the employment cycle? So what's clear from what I've said is that personal information is exchanged and processed at all stages. And during all these stages, the eight pillars or the eight rules apply. If we look at the next slide, which deals with more in more detail with the recruitment and other stages, I want you to point out that once the recruitment stage commenced, applicants are usually required to submit information about themselves in order to be considered. Often this is in the form of a curriculum vitae. POPIA will apply and must be, and the fact that this information is being collected must be disclosed clearly. There is an important interplay here between POPIA, the Labor Relations Act, and the Employment Equity Act. All three acts impact the recruitment stage. So if an agency is used, for example, by you as the employer, you must make sure that they understand that they are an operator for the purposes of a POPIA, and you would want to regulate their conduct to make sure that they don't cause liability for you or difficulties under POPIA. So when assessing the applicants, the employer will review their documents, possibly even conduct criminal or credit checks. This must be disclosed, and we strongly recommend that you obtain consent. Of course, depending on the nature of the job, a credit check may be extremely important if you're recruiting a financial advisor for a wealth management company or a teller at a bank. The employer will in this way access and retain information relating to applicants, and how it does so will be subject to POPIA. In part two, I will look at in greater detail the practical example of an employer using a recruitment agency, and we will unpack these with direct reference to POPIA. At this stage, I think it's important just to understand the information we're dealing with. So consent should be obtained from the applicant to this processing of information, the retention of the information, and the further processing of the information. It's necessary to comply with these legal obligations to protect not only the legitimate interests of the employee, but also pursue the legitimate interests of the employer. The information obtained from the applicants must be processed for the purpose of recruitment only. This is important. At this stage, you don't know who you're going to appoint. So one must bear that in mind. How do we destroy this information or de-identify this information if the applicant is unsuccessful? Only the information necessary to make a decision on who should be appointed should probably be processed or further processed. It should be gathered directly from the applicant if possible, or from public sources, or alternatively, if there are going to be reference checks, then that fact should be disclosed to the applicant for employment. If the applicant is successful and he or she is appointed to the vacant position, the disclosure of personal information continues beyond this point. They'll be required to provide further information, for instance, to join the employer's medical aid, as I've said. The employee will be required to provide information necessary to complete the contract of employment, and we know that that's permissible. Most, if not all of this, will be personal information for the purposes of POPIA. Then if we move to the next slide and we look at the stage beyond recruitment, the stage where there's this massive flow of information. So once the applicant has been employed, there will be various forms of personal information disclosed. Things such as Compensation for Occupational and Injuries and Diseases Act information will be liable to be collected at this stage. The employer must keep records of injuries, of illnesses, must take steps to report that information, in other words, further process that information to the compensation commissioner. The employer will also probably gather travel records for tax purposes, but this will also indicate where the employee has been traveling. Many employers intercept employees' email communication and telephone calls. This is personal information and often special personal information. Once again, whether it is lawfully processed or further processed is something that employers must bear in mind and must consider. The employee's union membership is another piece of special personal information that will be gathered during this time. Employers will typically disclose on a monthly basis to employees, to trade unions, the income earned by trade union members, the deductions made and paid over to the trade union. This information is personal special information, and consent should be obtained. Otherwise, it should be for a legitimate purpose, such as for trade union membership. So also, for example, information relating to the health of an employee must be processed by an employer to support a COIDA claim, as I've said. The processing of this information is necessary because the law says so. So again, we have an interplay between COIDA, Occupational Health and Safety Act, and the Labor Relations Act. The further processing too is lawful because the information must be passed on to the compensation commissioner. How else will that occur? Or to the Department of Labor. During this time, an employee will be allowed access, as we know, to that personal information and may request the correction of incorrect information if it is inaccurate or irrelevant. And the employer must provide for this process and expect it to happen. The employee may also ask for this information to be destroyed, as we know, and again, the employer must facilitate this process. So during employment, it is very likely that special personal information, such as relating to race, gender, and so forth, will be exchanged between the parties. An employer has an obligation to report to the in regard to employment equity. It has obligation to create a plan for employment equity. And in order to do so, it has to process that special information from the employee. Often employees are required to disclose biometric information in order to access or have egress from an employer's business or premises. This is also special personal information and must be borne in mind. In the example, I will show you how this information should be processed in terms of POPIA in part two. So it is also important sometimes for the employer to process information relating to the health or sex life of employees for the purposes of wellness programs and other programs in connection with sickness or work or incapacity. So for instance, as we all know, we're in the midst of a pandemic and an employer is under a positive obligation under the regulations issued under the Disaster Management Act to process information relating to body temperature, access to contact with persons who might be infected, symptoms and so on. This information is clearly of a health and personal nature, but the law again interplays here with POPIA and requires that that information be processed. If we can then move on to the next slide, and we now look at what happens to an employee at termination or post-termination, we once again will have a raft of information that arises. So for instance, the reason why an employee is dismissed is not something that should be made necessarily public. It may relate to very personal information, such as incapacity due to illness or sickness. It may relate to a disability, where the Employment Equity Act specifically provides that information must be treated in a specific way. Once again, we have the Employment Equity Act intersecting with the POPIA Act as far as processing of that information is concerned. The employer will retain specific forms of personal information, such as the reasons for dismissal. And that information might be processed further by reference to, rather by referring it to the CCMA or a bargaining council or the Labour Court, where these issues might be in dispute. All of this information, once again, will be subject to the 8 principles of lawful processing. After the employee's employment is terminated, there's obligations on the employer as far as the retention of this information. The employer will typically be required from the point of view of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, the Labor Relations Act, and various other acts to retain information, such as the employee's name, contact details, address, and the like. These details might include marital status, dependents, payments from pension funds, and such. It will also include directives that might have been issued under the Income Tax Act where the employee was retrenched. The processing of this information is regulated by POPIA and by, for instance, the Income Tax Act. The Unemployment Insurance Act requires this information to be retained for some cases for 3 years and in other cases for 5 years. So the retention and further processing of this information is regulated by law, and the employer need not necessarily obtain the consent from the employee. Then we can move on to the next slide. All of this information that I've identified will come into play in the employment relationship and the life cycle. It poses significant challenges to employers to ensure that they have the proper policies and procedures in place. In part two, I will look at a case study where I hope to illustrate how this information is processed, further processed, and what aspects of POPIA, Income Tax Act, and the other acts I've mentioned come into play, and hopefully assist you in understanding how to balance those legal obligations whilst at the same time protecting the rights to privacy of an employee. Thank you. At this stage, I'm ready to deal with any questions if there are.
Yeah, Jock, thank you. That is indeed an insightful presentation. And I would like to suggest what Jock highlighted so eloquently is the fact that we can never look at POPIA in isolation. In fact, we need to interpret and apply it within the broader legal landscape. And if we consider something like, an employment relationship and how the employer ensures proper consent by its employees, it introduces the fact that you need not have consent because you can rely on the legitimate interest, as Jock spelled out, that there are instances for pension fund, medical aid, and a host of other aspects where you need to process the personal information. And if you don't process it, the employer-employee relationship actually falls apart. So Jock, one of the questions mentioned in the Q&A session centers around the fact that you focused on a recruitment company and you referred to it as an operator. And the question is whether a recruitment company on their own and in their own right, whether they constitute a responsible party or can constitute a responsible party as well?
I think there is, yes, absolutely. They will be processing information that they obtain from the applicants, and they will be further processing that information by passing it on to the employer. So I think, yes, clearly the role of being a responsible party or a data subject can change. So for instance, an employer can be a data subject by reason of its interaction with another entity. So too, I think a recruitment agency can clearly also be that.
Indeed, and it links to the definition of a responsible party in the legislation. that specifically refers to the responsible party on its own deciding the purposeful processing or in conjunction with others, which introduces then the concept of joint controllers. And we can read a lot about this, and we've learned a lot about this in within the Worksman's team as to what happens in the EU. Jock, a further question presented by one of the attendees, and I'm going to read it out. If a potential employer phones me regarding a previous employee service track record, will this reference fall within the provisions of POPIA? In other words, to what extent may I provide a reference regarding a previous employee's service record? And I think that is a question that many people might sit with, because it's something that happens on a daily basis, doesn't it?
I absolutely think that is subject to POPIA. The reference that's being sought relates to all of the information I've highlighted today. So it could be performance, it could be personality, it could be a whole fitness to perform the job, what gave rise to the dismissal. And I would strongly advise in that situation not to disclose that information unless the employee has approached the employer to say, would you be a reference for me? And you can expect a call from X, Y, and Z. And I give you consent to give that information. I would think, yes, it is. It's definitely information that would be subject to the legal principles.
Yeah, I think that links to the fact that, you know, sometimes you might love consent and sometimes you might hate it. The reality is, in certain instances, you do need it. We look at special personal information, information of children, you definitely need consent. And this might then be a specific example of where consent becomes very important if you, as a ground for the justification in processing or then giving that reference. Jock, if we consider video and voice recordings and considering keeping POPIA in mind, to what extent may one do video surveillance in a company? I think it is a contentious issue. We see all the video surveillance happening specifically in the Gauteng area. So if we consider, and in the Cape Town area, if we consider company video surveillance, is it acceptable to do video surveillance at access doors for security purposes? And with inside the buildings, how do you deal with video surveillance from a POPIA and employment perspective?
So from an employment law perspective, the law is clear, and there have been several cases on this issue that sort of surveillance is not permitted in private areas, such as change rooms or toilets, obviously. I think that goes without saying. And then furthermore, another requirement that the courts have indicated is that the putting in place of surveillance should be published to the employees. In other words, there must be a legitimate reason. So that sort of ties up with POPIA, the need for a legitimate interest that the employer needs to protect, which could be the safety of its employees, of its stock, of its product, for safety and security reasons, but at the same time, the employment law would support that, and the case law does support that. So make it known. Make sure it doesn't infringe areas such as toilets and change rooms, and there must be a legitimate interest that you are pursuing, such as the protection not only of the employer but also the interests of the employee.
Can I just remind the attendees to the webinar, please, can you post your questions through the Q&A session and not the chat box? We worried that we might be missing something. Just to add to what Jock has said, recently in the EU, in the Fashion EU ID decision by the courts, what was highlighted, if we consider surveillance, video surveillance, or recording what happens on someone's computer or electronic devices within the workplace. If you bring your own device to work and the employer monitors it. The decision was very clear on, in itself, the concept of monitoring or surveillance is not a problem. However, the test comes as to what the extent of this monitoring is. To what extent will a company actually be surveilling and monitoring purely private activities of individuals? And this then is the asset test for surveillance, together what Jock highlighted, if we consider the issue of notification and awareness, openness, transparency when it comes to video surveillance. Jock, a further question, you know, if we look at permissions or whether specific permissions would be required for employment equity information or health and safety information and reporting, you know, companies don't have a choice. It's a legal obligation.
Right.
What about POPIA?
Sorry, what about POPIA?
To what extent does that apply? Or can I just, you know, is it a hindrance to the processing of the information?
No, because POPIA caters for that, where it's necessary to comply with legal obligations. So I think it's a framework. It works perfectly. Yeah. The two work together.
And then I think we also often confronted by the facts that clients are multinationals, they're global companies competing on a global level. So if we consider multinationals and global companies, you know, and sharing payroll information, HR information across borders, is this problematic? Is it allowed? Is it catered for in terms of POPIA?
It is catered for. Cross-border processing is catered for by POPIA. And it's important as the employer, you'll see in my example, I hope to cater for that in part two, where the information is stored in a service in the cloud in Norway. Whether that's possible, I don't know. I just thought it would be a good idea. But if you're going to process information or further process it across borders, you have to inquire into what measures the other country have in place to protect that personal information or special information. And it would be a good idea to make that known to the data subject that is what you are going to do.
So a follow-up question, what is your view regarding an employer investigating a prospective employee's personal background by assessing the person's Facebook and other social media in order to see the type of person the prospective employee is, as well as who his or her friends are, in order to make sure that the person will not disclose information to third parties? The specific example that the webinar attendee is mentioning, example, the employee will work with unions and his or her friends on social media are people who you know represent unions. Will you consider it as a red flag? No employer want information to be distributed to third persons. How should one deal with this, Jock, from an employment and company perspective?
I would assume that the social media platforms are open to the public. Otherwise the employer would be acting unlawfully, I would say, first of all. And so assuming that it is open to the public, then the employer is entitled to interrogate those sites. The interaction here between POPIA and the Labor Relations Act is important, though, because the Labor Relations Act says you can only seek information which is related to the inherent requirements of the job. So you will have to, so that's a legal right the employer has, and that must then allow, under POPIA, the employer to process that information because the law says it can. But the question is, how far do you go? And that is limited, at least by the Labor Relations Act, to what the Labor Relations Act therefore describes as a legitimate interest on the part of the employer, and that is the inherent requirements of the position. Yeah. So whether someone is a member of a particular political party and that person is applying for a job to be a teller at a bank, it would be clearly impermissible to try and process that information because it's unrelated to the inherent requirements of the job.
Yeah. Thank you, Job. Can I please request that we end the employment POPIA session for now? I would like to indicate to the audience that we are preparing various works briefs on some of the topics you've raised. For instance, bring your own device to the office, which we will be publishing with over the next 2 months. And those processes not in place in terms of topics, we will definitely take up and address during the works briefs, which is you can use as a forum for further information. I do, however, want to respect both Neil and Tracy and allow them the time to present on their topics. And therefore, we will move over to Neil Kirby. And Neil is speaking today on his first introductory part on the question of an information officer, a very important aspect from a POPIA perspective. We know the information regulator has highlighted this as something to focus on, and it can indeed be deemed a quick win from a POPIA compliance perspective. Neil, over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Amor. I'm also picking up on a theme that Jacques mentioned and Amor picked up on as well, which is how we need to integrate POPIA with other pieces of legislation. There's a tendency for people to focus on POPIA as an isolated incident or piece of legislation. I think primarily that's because of its heritage, where it was looked at and commented upon, dealt with and unpicked very much in isolation. It didn't have that integrated flavor with other pieces of legislation. And that was one of the reasons that we wanted to look at the issue of the DPO or the information officer, because it is, as Amor says, a quick win. It's also one of the aspects of POPIA that, whilst we're running through a transitional phase of a year, is something that's already required of you as members of the South African public, as private bodies, in order to appoint an information officer or a DPO. Now, when it comes to the practicalities, and that is one of the aspects we as a team have been grappling with, because we believe that the phase of conjecture to a large degree and supposition in terms of POPIA is coming to an end, and we need to get practical about how we are going to address the advice that we are providing to clients. And I thought it would be useful to start with the information officer, because it is a practical step that can be taken, and one that you would need to consider taking already if you have not done so, primarily because POPIA contemplates the appointment of an information officer as a matter of law. So let me give you the legislative context, that legislative point where you would, if you were so inclined to read, you would start, and that is section 55 of POPIA. So that's on the next slide. That is not the only place in which you should be looking. In fact, if you've read section 55 and you already have that legislative fear that a lot of people experience, that fear can only be enhanced as a result of Regulation 4. And Regulation 4 to the regulations to POPIA sets out the actual physical functions and duties currently of the information officer. And a lot of that in Regulation 4 is really without explanation within the legislation and is open to a great deal of interpretation. I think there's a reason for that. The reason for that is that the minister has tried in formulating those regulations to make them as broadly applicable as possible in light of the fact that they apply so broadly to so many different private bodies. But going back to my original point and the next slide, it's not only POPIA that we worry about, because the information officer is appointed with reference to another piece of legislation, and that is the Promotion of Access to Information Act, which has an equally difficult acronym to pronounce, PIA. So if I'm going to refer to POPIA and PIA, it's not a speech impediment. My parents took care of that quite a while back. But the information officer comes out of PIA. In other words, piece of legislation that is almost 20 years old. And the information officer under POPIA is in fact appointed with reference to section 1 of PIA, and that person is the head of the private body. POPIA begins to lean quite heavily on PIA in terms of the use of terminology, and I have confined my comments this morning to private bodies as opposed to public bodies, being bodies that are either part of the state or province or a municipality, or potentially are private bodies but conducting activities on behalf of a public functionary. So information officers are actually already in place, and your information officer under PAPEA is already there. That person might not necessarily know it, but in fact, that has already been, that role has already been fulfilled. Now, the questions we normally get that arise from persons who either have a presence already in South Africa or who are thinking about a presence in South Africa is how do you coordinate amongst information officers in various jurisdictions, especially where you might have a presence in a jurisdiction where the appointment of an information officer is a legal prerequisite. To a large degree, the practical answer to that is that multinationals will normally form a privacy committee or a data protection committee that is centered with or charged with the coordination of information policies throughout that company. The provisions of PAPEA are a little bit stiff in relation to an application of that nature internationally, because they do allow for the head of a private body to delegate the functions of the information officer to a deputy information officer. Unfortunately, though, the delegation does not allow for the appointment of a deputy information officer in anyone other than that private body. So conceivably, the South African institution would need to have a locally based information officer, but there is nothing that prevents the head of a locally based private body from appointing a deputy information officer that might sit centrally in another jurisdiction. It is an important aspect to coordinate, because that person is going to ultimately be responsible for local compliance with PAPEA, and moving on an assumption that because you're sitting in a jurisdiction where there might be advanced information laws does not necessarily mean that your deputy information officer in Canada is necessarily au fait or familiar with local conditions and local policies. The information officer does have defined roles and responsibilities, and those roles and responsibilities are set out in Section 55, read together with Regulation 4. These are difficult provisions to unpack, primarily, as I stated earlier, it's because of the broad nature of the language used in the legislation. The most interesting aspect, at least for me as a lawyer, and I understand that that's a relative concept because lawyers are relatively boring people and not doesn't take much to interest us, is that in Section 55 of PAPEA, there is an express obligation imposed on an information officer to encourage compliance. And I'll get to that in due course. But it certainly is something that speaks to the proactive role the information officer is going to be required to play in an organization. This is probably not a tick box function. It's not something you can say, well, yes, the information officer sits on the third floor and we've done the necessary, he or she has been given the title and he or she has a neatly covered lever arch file with PAPEA written on it. This is something that's going to require a great deal of application. Starting primarily with knowing what you don't know. And this goes to one of the regulations, one of the duties in the regulations, which is an impact assessment. It's a good idea to start with that in mind. To a large degree, with PAPEA coming in, we're all having to reflect internally as to what it is that we have from an information perspective, and we don't know what we don't know. We don't know, for example, how much information we need. We don't know how much information we don't need. And we also don't know where our weak spots are, or those areas that might require greater regulatory oversight from an information officer. And that's where the information officer becomes really important, because you have someone who is then focused on those areas, is able to begin highlighting and coordinate the treatment of information across the organization. And that all goes into the information assessment. At this point in time, we cannot tell you what an information assessment looks like, what it ultimately needs to achieve, But if one adopts a practical approach to PAPEA on a substantive basis, it is something that you need to perform in order to show potentially a regulator that you've assessed your organization, you've assessed the information it holds, you have policies in place for how that information is in fact processed or how it's needed and how it's controlled, kept, maintained, and stored, as well as how it's deleted. So that's where your information officer becomes critically important to the formulation of that policy and those policies across the organization and potentially across a great deal of time, bearing in mind that we sometimes are holding information that is entirely historic and rather redundant. So historically, yes, the information officer under PAIA was a statutorily passive role. It was entirely reactive. The most that person would have to do potentially is update an information manual once in a while and deal with requests for information that might be made also once in a while, if at all. Certain private bodies, I accept, have never historically had requests for information under PAIA, but that doesn't mean that you won't receive one. But that's beside the point. It is a passive role, and I think that at this point in time, that information officer is being bulked up by the provisions of POPI with the powers that have been afforded to him or her, as well as the duties. And I refer to that really as setting a watchman. You are appointing someone as a guardian and a responsible person for your information compliance needs, as well as somebody who can coordinate your information compliance potentially within an industry or an association, as well as with overseas principals, if that is the manner in which your business is structured. So it's somebody who is able to see danger coming. It's somebody who is able to advise on the correct policies, the correct approach to take in respect of information compliance under both PAIA and POPI. But then to encouragement. And the reason that I'm interested in this is that it's a very interesting legal term to be used in legislation. If you look at a similar process under, for example, FICA, which is the Financial Intelligence Center Act, where a compliance officer is also required, there is no reference to encouragement. The compliance officer under legislation like FICA has defined roles and responsibilities, and they are generally about compliance. But an information officer is required to encourage compliance with PAPEA. It does indicate that this is not going to be an easy task. It also indicates that you, as the information officer, need to create an environment or a culture of compliance. In other words, you make PAPEA or information regulation part of an organization's fabric. People are conscious of leaving files on desks or having telephone discussions in respect of sensitive matters in public, changing passwords on computers, or just maintaining a discretion in terms of how employees or members of the organization deal with and arrange their affairs in respect of information generally, both in the workplace and more importantly during a time of COVID-19 pandemic at home, where quite conceivably relatively sensitive information is lying around on dining room tables or studies or even in less sensitive areas of a number of households across the country. So the encouragement is interesting. It is a unique aspect of PAPEA and its imposition of obligations on the compliance officer. And it is one that I think is going to be one of the more interesting provisions to unpack from a legal perspective as to when an information officer will have achieved that level of encouragement that is legally acceptable under PAPEA. Moving then into the context of information in general and what it is that the information officer is probably going to have to deal with, I think from my perspective, PAIA is the most informative. And moving into the next slide, you're going to be dealing with more often than not the information landscape that already exists in South Africa. So you're going to appoint your information officer, but that person is not going to walk afresh into a landscape that is unpopulated by a range of decisions by our courts as to how PAIA and information actually works. So information is dealt with, and Jacques has touched most comprehensively on the type of information we would ultimately be confronted with in the workplace. It's about the data subject. And we are all data subjects vis-a-vis our employers, who themselves at times vis-a-vis other third parties might also be data subjects. We are bereft of any protection in relation to the special personal information that we are required to provide in certain instances. We just have to provide that information. The grounds of refusal under PIO do form an important basis for how we treat information. So the way in which PIO is organized is that it basically says you can ask for information, but I don't have to give it to you. I can actually refuse it. And those grounds of refusal will, in my view, begin informing the PIO and the way in which information is maneuvered and dealt with. Health records under PIO, obviously coming from a healthcare background, they are very important to me. And under PIO, they attract a particular degree of attention, which I hope to touch on in my second round because of the interaction and interplay between PIO and PIO. But if an information officer is going to get stuck into PIO, I believe that an understanding of PIO is incredibly important. The interesting aspects that our courts have touched on under PIO, to the next slide, are the way in which you address and assess the need for information in a particular circumstance. So assessing a request under PIO is important. It is equally important to assess the manner in which the PIO provides for the movement of information. What is the need for that information? As Amor said, how do I match the need for information with the expectation that is underscored by the provision of that information, and what am I going to do with it? And those two criteria, those two issues are most eloquently dealt with under PIO, and it is something that we've already crossed. So we aren't going to invent the wheel here. What we're going to do is we're going to refine the body of the car, if I can take that one step further. It is information that is required for the exercise or the protection of any rights centrally under PIO. Similarly, under PIO, that is a central element as to why information is being provided. And it is also one of those elements that informs whether or not information has been correctly treated whilst it's been in your possession. It's a fact-based inquiry with reference to our case law. In other words, information is provided where it involves something more than that the information would be simply of assistance, which is a minimum threshold requirement, and it is provided where it is reasonably required in the circumstances. This is not something where information is provided without cause or without a degree of circumspection in the circumstance. So PIO, the point there being that PIO has already given us an indication of how information is to be treated, when certain types of information requires a degree of attention that potentially is not self-evident, and also how, in fact, information will be treated when courts are looking at whether it's being used or necessary to exercise or protect a particular right, whether that right is constitutional, social, due delict, or contractual. I don't know if there are any questions for me. I'm sure I was incredibly clear, so there's probably no need for anyone to ask a question or two.
Neil, thank you very much. It is such an important topic, and one that we know people are interested in, the link between PIO and POPIA and how to interpret POPIA if we consider the PIO provisions, and that happens to be one of the questions. Does POPIA have an effect on the Section 51 PIO manual? And I think that is a million-dollar question that we as a team have discussed with the information regulator as well. So, if you can maybe share your views on that.
So there are two approaches. One is substantive, one is formative. The substantive provisions are you test your compliance with both PIO and PIO against what it is that is contained in your manual. The formative approach or school of thought is you have two separate manuals, one under PIO, in other words, to address particularly how PIO is going to operate within your organization, and one under PIO, which deals with the particular issues with which PIO deals. Regulators like the distinction or the clarity where you're able to whip out your PIO manual and say this is the PIO manual, and you're able to whip out your PAPIA manual when you're asked that particular question. Regulators do not necessarily want to apply their minds to whether or not one manual is good enough to have achieved compliance with both potential, with both pieces of legislation. I'm of the substantive school of thought. I believe you test, you follow the process that allows you to achieve the most compliance, if there's such a thing, with both PAIA and PAPIA. I might be in a minority there, but it is something that I think should be the ultimate test as to what it is that you should be doing.
Yeah, I think it is something that clients are thinking about at the moment. Yep. And how to actually reflect the 8 conditions yep. succinctly in a PAIA manual, where your PAPIA manual deals with so many more aspects directly linked to your business process. Neil, but what you've highlighted today again is, you know, PAPIA is not only about business processes and mapping business processes and understanding the flow of information, but it's actually understanding the core fundamental legal principles underpinning the privacy legislation. And one of the questions that the audience have posed relates to group companies and whether you have one PAPIA and PAIA manual for the group, or, you know, whether you have to formulate a PAPIA manual and a PAIA manual for each legal entity within the group. And I do believe that is important. Also, if we consider of late what's been happening internationally, if we consider binding corporate rules and the implication of recent court decisions in relation to privacy and the transfer of personal information across borders.
Yeah, I think the group company structure is an interesting question, because you want to proceed off the basis that you have a central, consistent policy for information and the way it's treated. Whether your HR is sitting in Johannesburg or Kampala, you'd like to be in a position where you know that those departments are dealing with information in a consistent manner, both in terms of processing it initially, as well as keeping and maintaining it. If, for example, you're sitting with a centralized server in Norway, it seems to be the country of the day. But if you're in a situation where your group is fractured along business lines on the basis that they have different business focuses, the information is going to be different, because of the nature of the business, which I think would dictate that there would then be a need for differences on a divisional or a group type basis, where you are dealing with different demands and the information is different. I recommend on that basis then that if there is that type of structure, I would think that you would have your information officer at the top of your information pyramid, and you would then appoint deputies into locally driven subsidiaries, in order then for there to be a degree of coordination, a degree of consistency, because I think it would be madness to have an information officer who is called to account for the activities of a subsidiary or a division, and that information officer is completely without any answers to what's going on.
Neil, and then a quick last question for you at this stage, because Tracy is standing by on another further important topic. Personal liability for an information officer, how worried should the person be that
I think they should be with absolutely sleepless at this point.
Because the one thing is for sure, it is not every second of the day not clear. And what Neil just said when he discussed the issue around group companies, this is not a cookie cutter approach. This is not pull off a template and roll it out across the organization. You actually have to sit down and focus a bit. But as I've said, we will be dealing with these topics further on the 8th of October, and then we will take into consideration the remaining questions, some of which, Tammy, I would suggest Neil did answer your question about the impact assessment, but we'll take it all under consideration for purposes of the 8th. Can we then now move over to Tracy and the whole issue around data breaches, cybersecurity bill that's out there? that we need to understand what this landscape actually means and what we could be confronted with. Thank you, Tracy. Over to you.
Thanks, Amal. Morning, everyone. For the purpose of today's discussion, we're going to focus primarily on security safeguards, and then on the next session, we'll be going into cybersecurity and the cross between the cybersecurity bill as well as POPIA. So if we start off with the most recent effect of COVID-19 and the fact that so many people are working remotely, a lot of companies are finding that there's been a tremendous increase in the amount of data breaches that have happened. And particularly if you're looking at the fact that, as Neil mentioned earlier, you've got sensitive information at home, using devices that not necessarily have the correct security measures in place. So it's opening up companies to a lot of data breaches and cyber attacks, which is becoming quite a common phenomenon. As at the 17th of September, the information regulator actually said that there had been 29 data breaches that have been reported to them since May of this year. So it's clear evidence that the trend is increasing amongst data breaches. And the reality is data has got value. Information around a person's ID numbers, people's bank accounts, particularly credit cards, is very valuable. And this information is able to be sold by fraudsters and third parties on the black market, and it can be sold more than once. So the fact that your information has been exposed and processed by an individual or third party can expose you to a lot of fraudulent activity going forward. And a very good example is that of what's happened with Experian now recently. When we are talking about data breaches, you need to be aware that it is quite a vast type of scenario. You can have normal cyber attacks, we can have phishing attacks, you can have data breaches as a result of your employees' own negligence, whether they will take and send an email and push to reply to all as opposed to replying to the nominated individual. You can have your employees going somewhere, losing a laptop or a cell phone or an iPad which has data on from your organization. That information can be accessed. And if there is not sufficient data encryption services on those devices, the information can be used by a third party. In fact, we've actually seen from a report that a vast majority of data breaches is as a result of employee negligence. So companies need to also be aware of that. It is very important that you be cognizant of your security policy, which you have in place, and that you continually take steps to update these policies. And if your system is lacking or your security safeguards are lacking, take steps now to update those policies and to get them to a standard where you'll be able to continue functioning with limited interaction and limited interruption going forward. Now, what are the consequences for a company for a data breach? First point of call is business interruption. And a very good example of this is with the recent data breach at Life Care Hospital, where the admission systems and their processing systems had to be basically put an end to, and they had to go on a manual processing system because of the data breach. Also, you'll find that if there is a data breach and the information regulator does come out and start investigating and undertaking a complaint and investigative process, they can then advise you to implement certain processes, which again could have a problem or an impact on your business going forward. There is the financial hardships, which you need to be aware about, apart from your regulatory fines, which can be imposed. There is possible cost of litigation. We've also realized now recently that the information regulator has mentioned that they're not happy with the fact that from an Experian point of view, they have basically sent out notices on the internet and through the government's gazette. And they've said that they would prefer that Experian actually goes in and notifies every single individual data subject of the breach. When you're dealing with 24 million people and 800,000 companies, to have to go and notify each company of a data breach can become quite a costly exercise. There's also been the reputational implication for you. As a company, people suddenly become aware that their information has been breached, third parties got it. I, as an individual, can be faced with fraud or anything happening from my personal information with banking accounts and that type of thing. You will lose trust in that organization. There's also massive implications around your competitors taking advantage of that, potentially saying, well, look, we've got sufficient measures in place to make sure that this type of thing will not happen. As I mentioned, there's also the regulatory sanctions. When POPIA does become fully enforced from next year, your regulatory fines is an amount of up to 10 million rand or possible imprisonment for a period of 10 years. And then we've got civil remedies, which is normal damages claim. And it's also important to note that the information regulator has recently in this week turned around and said that given the Experian breach and the fact that they cannot actually do much at this point in time in terms of enforcing fines and that type of thing, people should look at possibly implementing public class actions and instituting a claim against Experian. And if something like this does go to the fore, you as an organization will incur quite a lot of financial implications as a result of that. Moving on to the next slide then, focusing on what is data security. Now, as Amor mentioned earlier on, there are 8 conditions for the lawful processing of information. One of those focuses on security safeguards. And Section 19 of PAPEA places an obligation on a responsible person to ensure that the integrity and confidentiality of personal information in their possession or under their control by taking appropriate, responsible, and technical measures to prevent the unlawful processing of and accessing of information and loss of information. So how do we go about doing this? You need to make sure that you have got adequate security policies in place to try and safeguard against a data breach. Now, you can identify in terms of what Poppy has set out in Section 19 is you need to identify all foreseeable risks. This is your internal risk and your external risks. Poppy doesn't give you any prescriptions around how you should go and try and quantify these risks. So as an organization, you can adopt a risk-based approach. Have a look and see where your shortcomings are. Where do you think your the area in your organization is which is mostly being impacted or where the data breach can happen the easiest. You can then, based on that analysis, identify where you need to spend more time and where you need to spend more money on setting safeguards and measures in place. You also can able to determine your risk appetite in terms of what you're willing to accept and then quantify how far you need to go in terms of setting up a data program and a security program. One thing we do need to point out is that research which has been undertaken by IBM last month has actually established that companies who tend to spend more at the outset in terms of setting up adequate and responsible data security programs tend to suffer less in the long run, because by having adequate processes in place from the start, you're then able to quickly identify data breaches, monitor data breaches, and be able to put in sufficient steps to be able to deal with that data breach. Also focus on controls that protect against the highest threats going forward. You need to then do a regular verification of your safeguards, continually work on updating your system, look at what other information safeguards or practices are generally applicable to your type of organization, and test your system on a regular basis. It's not going to help you if you've got a system in place and you're not actually undertaking analysis to see, is it working? Is it up to date? What has happened in the market? Where have identified data breaches occurred? And how can we then take steps to prevent it happening to our organization? As was mentioned earlier by Amor, there is no one size fits all approach. Every single organization needs to look at their organization, what they are doing, and find a solution that fits for them in terms of a data system, as well as in terms of an incident reporting plan. So you need to develop a very clear and effective incident reporting plan. And this is something that you need to do from a multidisciplinary point of view. You cannot go and say, okay, well, it's an IT system, then IT must take responsibility and deal with it. You need to get parameters from everyone across the board involved. You need to engage with the legal department. You need to engage with IT, with risk management, with finance, with employment, HR. You need an individual from each of those departments to become involved in setting up an incident reporting plan and be able to then go and identify what are our shortages, where do we have shortcomings in our business operations we need to operate on. What do we do if there is an incident? How do we go about identifying when there has been a data breach? What is our immediate steps that we then need to take after that? Do we need to employ the services of an external third party to allow us to assist in managing this risk, in risk mitigation? What are we going to go and notify to members of the public? How do we notify this? You need a very detailed notification plan in terms of what you are announcing, who you are announcing to, and when you are announcing it. Now, under POPIA, there's a requirement that you need to notify the regulator as soon as reasonably possible of a data breach, and including the data subject, and they must be notified in writing. You need to also take into consideration facts around whether there is criminal action which is going to be instituted, if notifying is going to have an impact on that resources or criminal proceedings. You also need to look at what your process is to identify your data breach and to then implement safeguards and security measures to contain the data breach, but to still at the same time to allow you to continue operating. As I mentioned earlier on, you have to have periodic test runs of your incident reporting plan, see where there's shortcomings, and take steps to continually update and improve that. Training and awareness of staff is imperative. It doesn't help that you have got everything on paper and no one actually knows what the policies are. So you need to make staff aware. If there is an incident, how do they identify that incident? What do they do once that incident has been come to their attention? Who do they notify? Once that information has been sent to an individual, what do they then do? What is the next step? And this is all information which you must put into setting up your incident reporting plan, as well as in making sure that you've got sufficient security measures in place in order to protect possible data breaches. Moving then on to the next slide, possible example or the examples of data breaches. And of course, the most prevalent at the moment is that of Experian. And it's actually been recorded as being the largest data breach of the year so far. And that data breach is not as a result of Experian being hacked, but basically as a result of an employee physically handing over information to a fraudster. So it's pure negligence, if you want to call it, from an Experian's part. This information was actually only brought to the attention of Experian when they were doing a reconciliation of accounts. So the data breach had occurred in May. They only became aware of this in July. They then notified the information regulator on the 6th of August, and they obtained an answer pillar on the 18th of August. Through all of this, Experian has maintained that out of the information that has been reached, it's not consumer-related or credit information that had been obtained. But in actual fact, it's now transpired that the information which was disclosed is details around ID numbers, phone address, employment details, banking details. It's quite a lot of information that has been disclosed. And it's recently come to the fore that this information has now been able to be identified with specific individuals. So they've actually been able to tie together individuals' names, individuals' banking accounts, companies' names, companies' bank accounts, and allowing third parties to go and basically undertake fraudulent activity as a result of getting this information. Under POPIA, as was mentioned earlier on, you're only meant to obtain information for a specific purpose. And as can be clear from the information which your consumer bureaus, such as Experian, hold, they have got information which is much more than required, and also information which they're getting from third parties, not necessarily just from the individual themselves. The Experian data breach has also been exacerbated by the fact that the information has been set out on or put on a website in Switzerland known as WeSendIt. And as a result of this, the information regulator is now undertaking additional steps to assess the extent of the data breach has occurred, and also notified the Federal Data Protection and Information Commissioner in Switzerland. It is very important to note that the information regulator has made it very clear as a result of this breach that they are not happy with the way the measures and operational measures and assessments were put in place by Experian, and it's something that they're continually going to be investigating going forward. So companies and organizations need to be aware of the massive implications that this type of data breach can have on your organization. Additional example of data breaches includes that of Life Healthcare Group, as I mentioned before. Moving on to the next slide, where in the pandemic of COVID, there was a data breach. In this scenario, Life Healthcare Group was able to switch over to backup manual processing systems, which they had in place. So it is imperative that companies must make sure that they do have a backup measure. If there is a data breach, while you are trying to contain and consolidate and minimize the impact on your organization, make sure you've got a way to be able to continue doing business. So in Life Healthcare, they moved to a system of doing admissions and processing on a manual basis. Another example is that of Metropolitan, Momentum Metropolitan, where there recently was a data breach of the information of a subsidiary in the group. We have been advised that there's no client member data which has been released, but again, this is something that has happened recently. It's come to the fore. Garmin has now had their second data breach in the course of a year. They have advised in terms of the second data breach that there hasn't really been much of an impact on their systems, besides slowing down processing of certain procedures and that type of thing. But the reality is the reputational implication for a second data breach in 1 year is quite massive for them. Another data breach, which has also come recently to the fore, is that around the Department of Education, where information around the teachers who have comorbidities has actually been exposed. And that is something that is ongoing and being investigated by the regulator at the moment. So in synopsis, what does all of this come down to? And now, in moving on to the next slide, there has been an investigation that was undertaken by IBM of a number of companies recently. And that has revealed that data breaches are costing 40.2 million rand per breach on average amongst the companies that was investigated, which is quite a vast amount of money. The most predominant causes of data breaches has been human error, accounting to 26%, system glitches accounting to 26%, and malicious criminal attacks accounting to 48%. What was astounding to see was that the study has revealed that by companies and organizations setting up adequate security measures in place, making sure you've got a sufficient data security policy from day one in place, has actually worked at saving companies 2.5 million. Because this then allows you to investigate quicker, to isolate where the breach is, to contain the breach, and to respond to these breaches, and has a minimal or reduces the impact from a reputational and a business interruption point of view on the company itself. Again, having a proper incident report plan in place has saved companies approximately 3.4 million. So this again is an indication that it's imperative you set up your policies and processes now. Your incident reporting plan must be one that is multifaceted, where everyone is involved and everyone is aware of what the procedure is going forward. Attacks on customers and employees and corporate data is most prevalent. And unfortunately, with the recent pandemic and the fact that there are so many organizations that are still allowing employees to work remotely, this is going to continue. Thank you. And now, if there's any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Tracy. I think a couple of questions, and maybe it again points to the value of having a team with various areas that they focus on and expertise dealing with the poppy legislation within Worksmans. The first question that we got relates to employee emails and disclosure of personal information to fraudsters, imposters, for instance, phishing. We know phishing was became a yes. major issue during the whole COVID pandemic. And if this is in contravention to a company's employment policies, would this constitute grounds for dismissal? So I think, Jock, this is out and out an employment question. Mm. Employee not following the policies of a company, breach occurs, and you know what now? Can I actually fire him or her because they disregarded the policies? Jock, you're on mute.
Apologies. It's a question of how serious the offence is. Clearly, any act which is not in the best interest of the employer will lead to misconduct inquiry and could very well lead to dismissal.
Okay. Tracy, then, since we're running out of time, the next question, if a company experiences a data breach in this period, the 12-month period of grace that we're currently in, you mentioned that the information regulator herself indicated that she's been notified of breaches. The question is, should I be notifying the information regulator in this 12-month period of grace, or do I keep quiet and only do it after the 12-month period?
No, there's definitely a requirement that you do need to notify the information regulator at the moment. Whilst they may not have any actual powers to enforce and implement criminal sanctions or enforcement procedures, anything like that in the future, they do need to be aware of it, and they are actually investigating those breaches which have been brought to their attention. And it's through these that they have made it very well aware that there are shortcomings in organizations. And an example is the Liberty breach of last year. They are still in contact with Liberty on a very, from what I understand, on a monthly basis, getting updates from them, getting feedback on what they have done and what measures they've taken to try and rectify the breach and to put measures in place to make sure that the breach like that nature does not happen again.
Because I think the one thing we do know in our interaction with the information regulator and actually assisting clients with the announcement and dealing with data breaches is that the information regulator deems this a very important issue that ought to be addressed because it is in the interest of data subjects. So I think that leaves us with 45 seconds to close, and we thank you for attending. I thank the speakers and the effort and the time they've put in Jock, Neil, Tracy in preparing the presentations. As we've said, this is part one of a two-part webinar series, the next session on the 8th of October, and we look forward to meeting you there and discussing these topics in further detail. We've had various questions during the morning as to whether Worksmans do offer solutions, and yes, we do. There's a Worksmans Papia toolbox that can be custom fit per company and organization as per the needs. We've rolled out comprehensive e-learning, because what Neil indicated, one of the core duties of the information regulator is in fact training. And what we've just learned from Jock in terms of the second last question, if I want to dismiss an employee, I need to at least demonstrate that I've trained him and he knows what is expected of him. So we look forward to seeing you again. We welcome you and to host you, and we welcome you to the Worksmans family. Thank you for sharing the morning with us. Take care and have a good day. Bye-bye.